abundant gifts. Good morning, Father, Son. Thank you for feeding all living things on earth. Thank you, plant kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, animal kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, great spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep. It's a pleasure to have you join us today. I have a wonderful guest. Her name is Susan Grimaldi. She's a member of the Choctaw Nation and is based in Vermont at this time, where she's been practicing shamanism for over 35 years. She's internationally known for her work with communities in northern China, Inner Mongolia, and the Tuvan Republic, experiencing the living traditions of the Manchu and the Mongol people, including ancient harvest rituals, healing ceremonies, and actually interviewing Asian shaman. During the last 3 years, she's been documenting shamanic culture in these areas as part of an ongoing project of photographing indigenous visionary healers. So, Susan, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks, Caroline, for having me on your show.
Well, like I said, it is a pleasure, and I know you've had a very exciting life with all of your travels. But first, we would like to know a little bit more about you and your Choctaw heritage. Could you tell us a little bit about of the beliefs of your tribe and how and where you grew up?
I was born in Oklahoma, and my grandmother was a Choctaw tribal member, an original enrollee, and she'd been taken out of her home at the age of 8 and sent to the Wheelock School for Indian Girls, and at that time she made a vow to hold on to her heritage and remember everything that she could, and her intention was to pass it on to her children and her grandchildren. And she had a lot of enculturation then into the predominant white society, and she maintained her vow. And when I became about 7, she began to teach me her traditions at that time.
Oh, how wonderful that she made a vow like that and was able to keep all of that heritage. I read somewhere that you had become a dreamer at age 7. What exactly does that mean, being a dreamer?
When I was 7, I had rheumatic fever, and while delirious, I flew out of this world on the wing of an airplane, lying flat on my stomach and holding on to the front edge. And while I was out of this world, I was healed from the illness and also taught and given a lot of understanding and information. And when I came back, I was different from that point on and fell into trance very easily and was able to see clearly truth, and was it was a difficult time for me because I didn't have a lot of control over that tendency to fall into trance, and also seeing things so clearly sometimes created difficulties around me because some things people wanted to hide or they were trying to trick or fool people, and so I could sometimes cause some trouble inadvertently, not intending it.
Oh, my. Yes, people don't like their secrets revealed. Okay, well, wow, that's awesome. So then, did your mother, was she your primary teacher, or did your tribal shaman train you in how to use your gifts?
During the time when I was growing up, there was a lot of persecution, and also there had been a cultural genocide to the Choctaw people. There was very little of the traditions still intact at that time, and over the years there's been an effort for a renaissance of recovery, but so much had been lost. They had undergone a lot of missionary influence, and that was certainly going to be such that they forgot a lot of their old traditions. So my grandmother was my primary teacher. My great-grandmother was also living. She spoke very little English, and she was also helpful. Much of the training that they were giving me was under the guise of how to be a human being. And so I was being taught general skills of living, which included how to walk on the earth and how to respect nature and understand my place as being very small in comparison. And I was taught how to skin animals and how sacred their life is to sustain ours and how to grow food and how to can food. But I was also taught some of the hidden understandings about how to find things without looking. And there was also medicine that was being imparted about the nature of the healing components in the purity of water, for instance. So there was a lot that was being given to me. There was, because of the time I grew up and the level of persecution, there was a bit of strife in terms of this being taught to me, because my parents at that time were trying to be enculturated into the white society. They were passing somewhat and kind of had turned their back on their native ways, although my father had never met anyone that wasn't native until he left at 18 and started on his life. But so there was a lot of confusion at that time, and I think going post-cultural genocide, there can be a lot of disruption in the lineage. So my grandmother was teaching me somewhat secretly, and I was very compelled to begin healing right at that time at age 7, and wanted to help both grandmothers with arthritis particularly, and would really ask them if they would let me take their pain. And so I began actually doing healing work at a very young age.
Wow. Well, it's such a shame that so much of the wisdom was lost, and, you know, such priceless knowledge was treated as worthless. You know, that it just makes me sick to my stomach to think about it. But thank heavens your grandmother, your mother, your grandmother, and your great-grandmother were able to share as much as they knew with you.
Go ahead. What I wanted to add is that a lot of my learning was directly from spirit and also through dreams. And in that way, there's hope for humanity when there is a disruption in the cultural traditions. There's a direct access through revelation, through spirit. And so many people have teachers that are not in this world. And so that gives the world hope for any of this lost knowledge to still be practiced and recovered.
Yes, that's the wonderful thing about shamanism, because once we know how to journey and go to our teacher in the upper worlds, they have all that knowledge, and that's when we really begin to learn, because they teach us, you know, and that's wonderful. Well, it says that you actually began practicing the art of visionary healing at 19. How do you describe visionary healing?
When I was 19, I had an initiatory experience. I was in college at that time, and this was in the late 60s, early 70s, when there was some experimentation going along with entheogens, and I had never done anything like that, but someone in my dorm was having a very bad experience on a drug, and I was called in to see if I could help him, and my inclination was to touch him, thinking it would draw his attention to me. But instead, what occurred is that I fell into his reality. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had come from someplace, and I stood steadfast and held on to him and decided that if I could trace my way back the way I had come, I would be all right. And so I took him with me and mm-hmm. brought him back out of that nightmare, and he was fine after that. And he was very curious about what had happened, and of course so was I. And so I spent many, many years in exploring that question, what had happened. And so I would look for opportunities to engage in that kind of experience where I would touch people and who were having illness or some kind of suffering, and I would see if I could understand how to alleviate their suffering. And what I was noticing is that I was getting understanding that was coming in that every single moment, and I was being shown what to do. And that is what I think of as visionary. And so I was also noticing that the person would often fall asleep, and they would often have a dream that would coincide in so many ways to the vision that I was having of their healing. And then it dawned on me that we were sharing another reality. Mm-hmm. And so this was using the access to the visionary realm to engage the person outside of time for the purpose of healing. And all that understanding was coming directly from the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is so amazing, because instead of you lying down and journeying like I do, you actually, by touching the person, they went to sleep and they were doing the journey and you went along. I mean, that's amazing.
Well, actually, I think I was doing the journey, and they were going.
And they went, okay, okay. Yes. But it's amazing how just touching them made that connection that immediately put you into the other realm together.
Yes,
so
I,
that you could
I
work
was,
with them.
Yeah. I was chanting. That was the other thing I noticed. And this was this was before I ever met Michael Harner, mm-hmm. the founder of the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. And when I did meet him, this was in the early 80s. It was at a basic workshop. And mm-hmm. I didn't put together what he was doing with what I was doing, because we were doing it so differently.
Right.
I wasn't lying down, and I didn't have a blindfold on, and I was sitting up touching people and chanting. And many years after that, I did have an opportunity to work with him in his first experiential 3-year training. And it was during that time that I understood what I was doing was actually more advanced. And mm-hmm. There was a place for that kind of healing that was explored.
Yes. Yes. It's very advanced from what, for instance, I do. I trained with Michael in the early 90s, and that was my first introduction actually to shamanism, because I'd been searching for something my whole life, and I had searched through every religion on the planet, and somehow I had never thought about shamanism. And you know how spirit works. Spirit led me into it, and once I did my first journey, I'm like, I'm home. This mm-hmm. is what I was looking for. It was something I remembered from, I don't know, past lives, something that was very familiar to me. But and I'm an empath. I can touch and feel what other people are feeling and all, but it doesn't take me into that realm of spirit that you're experiencing. So that's wonderful. I wonder if you can train people to do what you do.
I have been working with several students over the years, and have found that it is possible for me to impart this knowledge if they have an innate capacity, a mm-hmm. gift for, or an ability to hear the guidance. And that's the main component. And if they're able to hear and be present to that understanding, then this knowledge can be conveyed.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful way of journeying or healing, visionary healing. I like that. Okay, well, moving on a little bit, you were invited to China to demonstrate your healing approach and participate in the opening of the Shaman Culture Museum at one of the universities in northern China. How did you become involved with Asian shamanism?
In 1995, I was invited on an expedition. At that point, there was a group. It was under the auspices of the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, and we were a team going into China as an attempt to see if there were any shamans still practicing in China after the repression during the communist rule. And things were loosening up a little bit, and we thought we could go in and begin to explore it. And we went to some very remote sections of the northeast portion of China, and to a place that there had never been any Western visitors, not even from Russia. We were the first visitors outside ever to visit. And
wow.
We found a shaman that was willing to do a healing, it was a harvest ritual, and he was considered a select shaman. He had been chosen by spirit, and he had maintained the knowledge all through this repression. And we filmed him, and we were able to film another shaman we found, and then we then found out we were being interceded. The secret police had intervened, and they had been following us and on our bus, and they had decided what we were doing was a political statement, because we coming from the outside, and we were focusing on this particular aspect of this artifact of culture.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
They prevented us from proceeding, and we wanted to fulfill our mission, and so we met privately, unsure of whether we were being bugged and our wires tapped, or room, we were being under surveillance. And we decided we were going to go ahead with our mission, and we went ahead against their authority and crossed the Gobi Desert and went into Inner Mongolia. And then we worked out an arrangement with the officials there in Tungliao to meet with the shaman and his apprentice, but it was under the guise of complete secrecy. We couldn't go in the village. We couldn't be seen in public with the shaman, and we had to meet in a clandestine location, which we did, and we filmed this Mongol boar and his young female apprentice. And this is the video was called Drums of the Ancestors, and is still in distribution. And then what that did is it things started to change then the years that followed after 1995, and things began to shift in their culture, and there was a lot of social change, and they were looking for alternative ways of addressing much of the suffering there. They didn't have enough psychologists and psychiatrists, counselors, and they needed help. So they finally realized they had a potential resource in their traditional shamans. And so all of a sudden they became very interested in receiving this knowledge. And I was had the only contemporary footage, and they knew I had it, and so they requested it all. They wanted it all, the uncut footage,
and
so we sent that back, assured that that everyone was going to be safe, and so they also wanted the video as well. And then it was because of that video, and I had been the producer and videographer, and I did all the editing. So I became, plus they knew I was Native American, and they knew I had a successful practice in Montpelier, Vermont. And so they wanted me to come and consult with Communist Party officials on my recommendations for reintegrating shamanism back into contemporary Chinese society. And that's what the invitation in 2007 was about. And so I also, they were wanting to know if I would be willing to donate my costume to be in a permanent collection in this museum dedicated to the shamanic culture. And I decided to make that donation, even though it was a hard sacrifice on my behalf. I wanted to somehow make that contribution to stir the interest and also inform them and educate them about the traditions around the world. And so my costume and all my accoutrements at that time, I donated them. They're in a case in a room in this museum. And so I went to China and met with the officials. And then because social change can be rather cumbersome, just before I was to make the actual demonstration, people got really scared, the people who had invited me, and they were concerned that they were going to be getting in trouble because they weren't assured that the people above them were going to feel that this was okay for them to be doing it. And I think part of the pressure came because news media got wind of it, and it was going to be aired on primetime television news on three different channels. And so they sat me down and leaned over me, very intimidating, and said that they wanted to make one thing perfectly clear, that they wanted it to be just an act. They didn't want me to do anything real. I'd come all this way, and then that's what they said. And they said, "Do you understand?" And I said, "I understand, but I was thinking, but I don't agree." And so when the time came, they took my costume out of my regalia, out of the museum, and they dressed me, and all these television cameras. The crews were there, and the Communist Party officials, and they had also faculty that had come in from all these universities to be present. And so I decided that I'm not going to fake. I don't fake. I don't.
Yeah, we can't.
How,
we can't
fake.
It's real.
So I decided, right. So I went ahead. excuse me. And I went in to. A heightened state and ask for a blessing for the seeds of this knowledge to be spread throughout China and to clear away all obstacles that would stand in its way for its reinstating this gift back to their culture. And people, they could feel the power of it. I got reports that people's hair was standing up. And and also, I could sense that there were two people in the audience that had melded with me and come with me in my experience. And so I knew that all of a sudden that this one man who had been ostensibly a professor and a researcher of shamanic traditions, he was a secret shaman. I could feel his spirit with me. And then the man next to him, a few chairs over, had a spontaneous experience when I was drumming. And so that was exciting. I was very well received. Then people started asking me to do healings, which was unheard of, and actually doing healings in public. This was all new. It was just the cusp. And because I didn't get in trouble, it meant then that it was safe enough for the shamans to come out. And they began, after I left, they began then practicing. I had made several recommendations, and one of them I felt would be to begin working with troubled youth using the drum. And this was very successful, and people started doing master's programs in colleges on shamanism, offering degrees, and books started being written by professors, PhDs were being written. So it became a renaissance. And then 12 years passed, and then in 2011, we went back went with my partner and colleague, Dr. John Lawrence, an anthropologist, and we went back to see a practicing shaman. She had been taking notes, and she had 30 notebooks of all her work, and we wanted to see her healing technique. This was a Daoer shaman named Su Xinghua, and we also met one of her who had been an apprentice. Her name was Wo Jifan, and she had become a full-fledged shaman after her training. And we met with both of them, and we filmed them, and we've just completed a new video documentary on the Daoer shamans. Partly, we did this because we wanted to help them in their need to become recognized by the government as an ethnicity, and in specific, we wanted to help them having their shamanic traditions elevated to in their in historic registry. And so we made this video primarily for them, but we're also showing it in the United States.
Oh, Susan, that's so wonderful, because actually you opened the door for all of that.
I think the real urge came from the need of the people to have that spiritual dimension reinstated, and I think I served a role in that simply by being outside their culture. I was they couldn't persecute me. I couldn't be reeducated or in any way hurt if I went past their boundaries. And so when I served, I think, simply as a catalyst.
Yes, you did. But it's wonderful. My goodness, you opened the door, and now they're embracing shamanism. And what a gift for them to be able to restore their roots and get back to the spiritual side of their lives. That's wonderful.
Yes, I think it is, and I think people really yearn for that experience, and because there was that deprivation for so long, I think that's why it's brightened up so quickly and been resumed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because under that long communist regime, any spirituality was pretty much stamped out, or they tried to stamp it out, I believe. So
The shaman we had met in the first village that I mentioned, where he had done a harvest ritual, he confided that even though everything had to be done in top secret and make sure everything was underground, he said even during that period, Communist Party officials were still visiting him for getting help. And so it never completely died out. It just went underground during that period.
Okay. Wow. That's an awesome story. You've had so many wonderful adventures with this. You were mentioning your costume that they wanted for their museum or whatever. What kind of costume do you typically wear when you do healing work?
The costume that's in the museum was made of doe skin, and I had seen this in a vision, and it had also come through my tradition, and I had decorated it with beautiful beadwork, again, from my experience of direct revelation being in vision. It had a beautiful bird on the front that was embroidered in beads of the morning bird, and had rattlesnake design down the arms, And I also had a beautiful feather headdress that I had made with hawk on the wings. And then I made buffalo drum. And I had a sacred pipe that I had donated that was needing to be protected. It was in fragile condition, and it was given to me, and I'd had it in my family for many years, and I did moccasins that had been passed down through the generations that were very delicate that I felt that I would benefit from being in a museum. They're a part of that now, and I had a belt that went with it with beautiful squash blossoms that had been my mother's. And so it was very personal, and I had handmade everything.
Oh, my.
A rattle that I had made that was in the shape of a turtle. And when I visited last time, we were there again, as I mentioned, in 2011, and I was back at the museum and visiting my costume, and it was emotional to see it there and behind glass.
Yes, and so far from home.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's wonderful, because I'm sure it's inspiring to them just to look at that and feel its energy. Because it has an energy from you using it through so many of your healings.
Well, I think it excited them too, and it made them curious, and they wanted to try it out. I just got word, actually, there's a book that's coming out in China featuring me and my work, and they're asking me now for photographs, and I was kind of surprised.
Oh, my.
Book about me in Chinese.
Yeah, that's
Mandarin.
That's something. Yeah. Well, we should have a book about you in the U.S. You need to write a book about your childhood and how you, you know, all the things you were telling me earlier about how you learned and what the conditions were that you were learning under and everything. Because I think it's something that people would love to know and would be a great bestseller for you.
One of the things that I look back now on that time of my life and I realize it's really what has left me with such a passion to want to preserve these cultural traditions, and that's been a lifelong interest of mine. I did work in the Amazon on the Rio Negro with the riverine people, working to try to help them preserve their culture because they're in the balance. Once they leave their preserves, they're at high risk of then going into a city. And so we were working with them to try to make sure that they knew how important their language is and their traditional clothing and their songs and their healing practices. And and now our work has been focused in Mongolia. And we've been working with a group of reindeer herders in the far northern region and near the Siberian border. These are called the Tsatan, spelled with a T, T-S-A-A-T-A-N. And what we're concerned about, again, I'm working with my partner, John Lawrence, and what we're concerned about is that there are only 400 of these people remaining in the world, and they are split into basically two areas, the East Taiga and the West Taiga. And because of the global warming now, it's putting a certain stress on the reindeer. And this is a herd that's existing in the, it's the furthest southern herd in the world. And so, and they're only 15 kilometers from the Russian border, and they aren't allowed to cross the border. And so they are held now up against this wall where if it gets too much warmer, the question will be, will they survive? Will their way of life survive? And so we were in this area 2 years in a row, getting to film their shaman ceremonies and get acquainted with their way of life. And so what I found, like in China, we went in at this time in 95, and that material was used to reseed shamanism back into the culture. And this may be the case eventually with this material that we're gathering now.
I hope so.
Culture has any interruption in their capacity to have this lifestyle. It may be that these documents eventually will be important to receiving their culture in a future time, in future generations.
Oh, it's so important. And with so few of them left, and all of that could just disappear in the blink of an eye. I'm so glad you're documenting everything. Tell us a little.
When I was growing up, because the culture had been lost, so much of it was lost, I felt bereft. And there was a great grief of that loss. And I think that's what has compelled me to be so devoted to this work in other cultures that are facing potentially a similar plight.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was very excited when I read that you had worked with the reindeer people. And I know it's a rigorous journey just to get to them. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about what you had to go to just to get to the reindeer people?
Well, it took us about 24 hours to get to the capital of Ulaanbaatar, and then we had to get on an airplane, and we flew as far north as we could, and to a place called Maroon, and then it took us about 14 and a half hours to drive several hundred kilometers off track. It was maybe 340 kilometers to an outpost, and we were going over mountain passes and through rivers in a four-wheel drive, really rugged vehicle without a road, basically, and it was very slow going and very, very rough and difficult and somewhat kind of dangerous. And this last trip, we really didn't have good brakes. And the person was having to downshift to get us to slow down. It's a little scary at times. But,
and what?
Go ahead.
What were the altitudes there? What altitudes
Went over, finally, when we got to the base camp where we were going to have as our headquarters, we then got on horseback, and then we started getting into the higher elevations. I think we were at about 9,000 feet, if I remember right. We were, Mongolia is about the size of Alaska, and it's very sparsely populated. We were in huge tracts of mountainous land without any human inhabitants, but then there would be this little band of 80 people that we were trying to track down, and it took us days of hard horseback riding, 10-hour days trying to find them. They're nomads, and they move around, and so we found the one band in the East Taiga, which is very exciting to see the teepees. They live in teepees, and we could see them in the distance, and we could see the reindeer herd, and they were so wonderful in welcoming us, and such warm, kind people, very generous in spirit, and that was our first contact with them. And then we went back then this last year to the same band, and then we extended our territory and then went to the West Taiga as well, which was even harder to get to, believe it or not.
Yeah. Oh,
my
goodness.
It was one of the hardest trail rides, I think, in existence. It was very rocky and very steep. And
dangerous.
We were in a gale force wind with sleet and really driving rain. We were trying to set up a tent, and I guess the winds must have been 60 miles an hour, and we were wet, and it was very cold. It's cold that far north at this, even in the summer. We were there in July, and we were, it was freezing every night down to freezing or below. And then in the daytime, it could get up to 90 degrees. So there's quite a lot of fluctuation, and that's part of the stress on the reindeer. It's getting too warm. The permafrost is starting to melt as well, which makes it even harder to get in and out because of the boggy conditions. We're in danger of having our horses get stuck and flounder.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I can't even imagine being on a horse for 10 to 12 hours a day and at 9,000 feet. I can barely breathe at 9,000 feet. I was in Colorado a couple of months ago, and my friend there took me foraging up in the forest at 9,000 feet. I could hardly breathe. But you were on horseback 10 and 12 hours a day at those altitudes and over that rocky, and it was freezing, too. Oh, my goodness.
We weren't always at 9,000. There were times these were where we were cresting over these passes, and we'd come down. I think the people were living closer to maybe 7,000 feet. So we would only be temporarily at the 9,000.
Oh, okay. Well, even so, with the global warming, they're going to have to keep moving higher and higher in the altitude to where it's cooler. But is there food for their reindeer if they move higher?
I think they have to be in a valley, these high mountain valleys, because they depend on the water, and the water flows down off of the mountains, and they need a certain amount of water for the humans to live too, and also for the reindeer. I think they pretty much maxed out where their terrain is. I don't know how they're going to really solve this problem. I don't have enough information really to know, but they did mention it. They were very concerned about the changes. They one of the shamans that we met named Haltzen, one of the things he said is that he's most concerned that the rivers and the lakes are lower and that the water levels are continuing to decrease. And he thinks it's because of the wrong treatment by people that's caused the moon and the sun energies to become unbalanced. And that he says that the moon has gotten dirty and that it's made the moon lose energy. And that he thinks that prayers will help. And he's calling for everyone's efforts. He said everyone's efforts are needed. And he said yours and his and mine. And he thinks that if the shamans in Mongolia do their shamanic rituals for the moon, and that if we do as well, that if we all put our efforts together, that that this will save the nature and that nature will survive. And that's one of the main messages he wanted us to bring back, is the knowledge of how to do ceremonies that will heal the moon and balance the energy between the sun and the moon and the earth.
So have you done those kind of ceremonies since you came back?
No, not up to this point. I've been, we just got back in August, and I haven't had a chance to conduct any ceremonies at this point. But I want to be teaching people to do it, and we're writing articles, and we're producing a new video, and hopefully this capacity will be understood. I think there are many ways for people to consult directly themselves with their connection with spirit and find their own rituals. I don't think we need to do one like his. I think we each have our own way of engaging these potentials. I think it's the intention that we share to try to help restore this balance and and show that we're working together.
Yes, I feel that, you know, we're so out of balance with nature, and here in the United States there's such a disconnect between people and nature. So many people are in the cities and so caught up in their lives and their technologies and their cell phones and their, you know, everything digital, and they've lost their connection with nature. And that's part of what I'm trying to do with this show, is remind people that we need to reconnect with nature, and we need to thank the trees, and we need to thank the animals, and we need to thank Father Sun, and we need to thank the water. We need to show our appreciation, acknowledge them, and show our appreciation and our thanks, because they're feeling very abused and disrespected at this point.
It's a wonderful contribution that you're making to help people remember that life is being sustained by this balance.
Yes.
And to really feel grateful. I noticed that with the difference in this group that I'm talking about, the Tsaten, they don't have all this distraction, and they have this magnificent, majestic place of living, and they have a rhythm of life that is absolutely, in every moment, they're aware that their life is sustained by the ground that they walk on and the energies that bring this balance of life. And there's a real comfort that they exude by having this ability to walk with this awareness. And also, I think that their sense of belonging to their group is also a great comfort that helps them to be relaxed. I think so much has been lost in our way of life that they hold in their everyday experience that we can learn from.
Yes. Well, yes, I think we've come full circle, and we've come back to the beginning when people really understood that they were part of the earth and that part of nature, and that we're all one, and to begin to live like that, you know, as if we're all family.
It's a great joy once we come to that place in ourselves. There's this bright, happy feeling of potential, of unity, and the capability of having an effect, because we can be a part of this great picture of all of us being understanding, sharing the understanding that we're all a part of nature, we're an aspect, and that when we join together with that kind of reverence, there's a relief, because we can feel the power of belonging and the power of effecting a change.
Absolutely. Because we really are all one, no matter how it looks. I mean, I hear so many people today like, oh, well, it's dirty out there in the forest. I don't care about hiking. It's dirty. And, you know, and they're so afraid of germs and so afraid of animals. And what would we do if we got lost or something happened? I mean, they're fearful of nature, and we have to bring them back.
We had to overcome those feelings during this last journey. I remember when I was getting off the horse, you know, there's lots of excrement from different animals on the ground and mm-hmm. things, and there's no bathrooms and no running water and all that, and I would no bathing, and I was kind of reluctant to sit down on the ground actually for a bit, thinking, well, I'm going to get manure on my pants, and pretty soon that became very unimportant, and I was sitting on the ground like everyone else.
Yes, I think we've been programmed by television commercials that want to sell us all kinds of things that will kill germs and will keep everything pristine and pure and, you know, germ free, and we forget that we're part of nature, we're animals too, and it's natural to be a part of all of that.
You know? One of the things I wanted to share before our time is over, I am so amazed in my research how many similarities between the cultures that I visited, how many of the shamans have similar approaches to healing. And they may call it by a different name or understand or go about it in a different way. But what I've seen that they generally across the board will practice what I call extraction healing. They'll maybe use sucking or mashing or some other technique to pull out what doesn't belong in the spiritual plane. And what we discovered now in this new research is these shamans in Mongolia that we visited, they're using what they call repairment, which is to repair the soul. And it's very similar to what we call soul retrieval here.
Oh.
And they're also doing depossession work, which is very interesting. They use the clothing of the deceased wandering soul that has attached to a living human. They would use clothes to draw of the deceased person to draw them away from that person and lure them back to their own clothing, and then take that clothing on to a mountain and leave the clothing, and then they would treat that clothing with juniper smoke to make a trail for that person's soul then to pass into another realm.
That's so sweet. Yeah, so they can follow the smoke up. Yes.
Yeah, they can follow the smoke trail. So they have their way of doing things, but it's also familiar to the practices that we're being taught and seen in our work in the United States.
Yes. And I know that some of your team members had healings done by the shaman over in Mongolia and all when you were there. Did they... Have they had lasting improvements in their health and their lives from those treatments?
Yes, absolutely. In every circumstance, there's been improvement and relief.
Oh, that's
in fact,
awesome.
I wanted to add that the shamans have been asking me to do healings for them in these this last visit and in subsequent visits as well, which I find very interesting that they have the trust and the interest in working with them, yes, as I do with them.
So yes, it's a great honor. It's a great honor for them to ask you, and that's wonderful. Susan, we are running out of time here, so I do have to close. I'd love to have you on again. You have so many wonderful stories to share and so much wisdom and all, so perhaps somewhere down the road you'll grace us with your presence again. Okay.
Oh, I'd love to, Christine.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Caroline. It's been a great experience.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you so much, Susan. And thank all of my listeners. Have a wonderful week. Next week, we have the Hawaiian shaman, Serge Kahili King, will be on. And so join me next Friday. And until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.